Walk on.
A simpler horse and low horsepower life, as it used to be on many farms in the 1940s and 50s.
Whoa!
And life now, after decades of huge change in machinery size and technology, farm sizes, the labour force, the costs and the challenges. Village Voices isn't attempting to sort all that out. We will, though, be holding up a mirror on those decades of change in all its forms, in a very local and honest rural picture of life on farms surrounding Legburn and Courthorpe over the last 7 or 8 decades. At the beginning of this story's time frame, some farms were still using horses for ploughing and carting and pulling binders and reapers.
Mr. Davy also has 2 horses which are only used for agricultural carting. Tractors were introduced on the farm 2 years ago, and now Mr. Davy owns 2 tractors fitted with a tractor cart and tractor plough.
But I can just remember working with a horse. We had a couple of horses, a mare and a stallion, and I think I remember I could saddle it up and back it into a cart. I think the last thing that I can remember as regards the cart was, it was for turnips, tonnips and potatoes.
The pace was much slower in the decades after the Second World War. Land was cheap and there were many more small farms, and a lot of work was done by hand.
I can remember cleaning the crews, people coming in to help Dad with muck fork. No tractors involved at all.
At Kennick they had a sail reaper, and it used to put lever in heaps for the people to tie up, usually the women.
Geoff Wright, Vic Borrell, with the voice of Jenny Cartwright, reading from a local 1948 study by Jean Mabelson. The reapers mentioned there were, by this time, largely used for cutting grass for hay. Reaper binders were still widely in use for harvesting cereals, tying them up in sheaves to be picked up and stooked, or more likely stacked if you live in Lincolnshire, and later stacked in the farmyard ready for threshing gangs.
There's a traction engine to drive it, a steam traction engine. Then there's a thrashing machine. Some people called it the drum. It separated the corn and put it into bags. The elevator put it up to make a stack.
Hank Green remembers it all too well, mainly because he always got the dirty jobs.
Odd times, if they wanted extra hands, I've been out thrashing, but usually, irrespective of what he told me Dad I was going to be doing the farm, I usually finished up in the chaff hole, which was one of the muckiest jobs out.
Geoff Wright and his father farmed in Courthorpe. Harvest time meant some very hard work and long days.
You get 2 or 3 people from the village helping, perhaps the threshing men with the steam engine, and winding up on a hicking barrow, 16 stone and 18 stone for beans. I mean, these gentlemen used to carry up steps up into the granary.
It was all hands on deck. The women folk of the farms were the standard bearers for equality. They played a big part in the work of the farm, especially at busy times like harvest, helping with the stouking and stacking and the leading in of the sheaves. Even the chickens were dragged in to help. Literally.
After you've got the stout sheaves off the field, you pull the chicken houses out. It was a source of food for the chickens for several weeks.
When you say you pull them out, of course, they used to be on little
wheels. On little wheels, yeah. Yeah, on little wheels.
Farm workers, not the chickens, of course, needed something a bit extra to keep them going.
They wouldn't do it without they got a beer ration. Because in those days, beer was that good, it was acted as a food. Beer was subsidised by the government. Penny a pint. It was good stuff. They reckon a man could work all day on beer. And they did do.
They certainly did. Sometimes up to 6 or 8 pints a day. Hard work wasn't confined to the harvest season, or to arable farms. Paul Moore remembers the long days his Uncle Eddie used to put in on his Church Lane farm in Legburn.
Early morning milking, work all day on the land, whether he was cutting hay or whatever he was doing during the day, and then be fetching the cattle back in the evenings. letting the cows walk the way home from whichever field they was grazing. And he'd often be milking, you know, 10:30 at night before he'd be finished.
Eddie, though, did have a secret weapon when it came to his dairy cows, the village kids.
My friend Carol and I, on a Saturday afternoon, we'd go down to the farmer down Church Lane and we'd watch the cows be milked, and we'd even go out with him on his tractor for haymaking. I mean, you wouldn't do that these days, but, you know, because of health and safety and all the regulations. Eddie Moore was friendly with my dad, you see. I think they were at school together.
Children were very useful and cheap.
When we had to move the calves, they were just wild. That was when we needed a lot of kids on the bikes with sticks to try and herd these cattle, because these calves, I remember taking them from here on the Reston Road down to a field in Carlton, and there'd be half a dozen calves or whatever in the field, and he'd literally open the gate, let them go, and then you just had to steer them, and they would gallop off down the road at a fairish pace, and the kids would be tearing after them on push bikes.
Yes, I can remember those days. I used to put in long shifts on my uncle's dairy farm at Aspicum Fenby, helping with the milking and every job on the farm, from when I was about 12 until I went into the sixth form at school. 10 bob for a weekend. That's 50p. Mind you, in those days, that would buy about 5 pints of bitter. David Harrison was also one of those children, helping to lead bales on the family farm in Furze Lane.
It was too heavy to get any height, so you had to have 2 men really to lift it any height. I was the young boy, so I used to be at the top on the stack.
On the stack.
Yeah, so I was lucky in that respect. Yeah, I can still throw a bale up.
Many farms, as we've already said, were much smaller in those early pre- and post-war days. The Church Lane farm of Eddie's father, Arthur Moore, was a prime example.
Mr. A.W. Moore began his milk farm in 1922 with 1 cow, which cost £35. This cow gave 4 gallons of milk a day, and it was worth 8 old pennies a gallon.
An extract from 20th Century Legburn, voiced there by Rob Alcock. Not long afterwards, the herd doubled in size, and increased by about a cow every 2 years through the 30s and 40s.
Towards the end of 1922, another cow was purchased for £18, and the 2 cows yielded approximately 6 gallons of milk a day, which was delivered to Grimaldby Dairies 6 miles away. Gradually, the herd was increased to 16 cows, and dairies collected the churns from a stand near the village pump.
It was a similar story at the Davy Farm on Manby Road.
Mr. Davy keeps 30 head of cattle, 4 milkers, 4 milk cows, 7 steers, 6 calves, and 9 cows in calf.
Change really began in the 1950s and 60s, but the machinery that came in to replace the horses, and some of the men, was still very basic and small.
Father, I suppose he had the biggest tractor around here, the KSLA, 40 horsepower. That was a big tractor. Most of the other tractors were standard Fords, about 20 horsepower. They got it done, but it took a long while.
If it was out on the farm, that's where it was repaired. You didn't have anything to bring it into a workshop. A lot of them were still horse-drawn things, but they'd been converted to go beyond tractors.
Colin Crust's father had a small farm of about 120 acres in Cawthorpe. It was a time when land was cheap and small farms were self-sufficient. Vic Borrell's father tenant-farmed between Cawthorpe and Hafham Top. They say neither could exist now as they were then, unable to compete with the big boys.
I loved it, but you just couldn't compete with them men. And if, a 20-acre field came in for sale, we would be very interested in buying it in them times. But now the price on it is, you'd never get it paid for.
Oh, you couldn't stand it.
The crops would never pay for it in a lifetime.
No, it wouldn't.
Did they reckon that if it was stock or crops, crops wanted to pay for it in 2 years.
That's right. Years ago, the price of an acre of land was based on what you could sell your crop for. There is several small farms, but they're nearly all stock farms. I still go to one or two small farms, about 100 acre, 120 acre. One man I've done his bale for 40 years. He has a lot of livestock and just enough corn for his own needs.
Cost pressures and much tighter margins made small dairy and mixed farms in particular much harder to keep afloat. Jeff Wright decided to get out while the going was good.
The price dropped and dropped and dropped, and everything else went up and up and up, and it got so by it really wasn't worth the hassle, unless you've got something that's completely out of the ordinary. It was suggested to me by somebody that I went in for ostriches. But I didn't take that any further. I mean, 100 acre now is nothing, is it? You'd have to be very, very intensive as regard to us. More like a small market garden. But by God, that's intensive, isn't it?
Eddie Moore did manage to keep going in his minimalist way. But his nephew Paul doesn't know how he did it.
At most, he probably farmed 45, 50 acres. But I don't think that was for long. I think generally he had about 35 acres. He'd probably only have 5 or 6 acres of crop. And the rest of it, really, he just used to keep for grazing and for hay. However he made a living out of it, I don't know.
The Harrison family moved to Legbourne Grange Farm from Saxelby in the 1960s. A mixed farm, but they built up a large dairy herd. David and his brother Richard split the business after their father died, David having bought the nearby manor farm. He concentrated on the arable side for both farms, while Richard, for a while anyway, kept the dairy herd. Both farms in the end, though, had to diversify.
It's just the economy of scale. You know, you get a machine, it's so capable of covering big acreages, and it needs to because of the sheer cost of them. Like ourselves, we ended up not enough acres to justify a living, really. So we had to diversify. And so it's easy, you let it out and let someone else do it, or you try and take on a neighbour's land in various forms, either rent or combine. You know,
working together.
Yes.
Shrinking margins, lower milk prices, and land pressure persuaded the Harrisons to sell the dairy herd. Richard, and later his son Jack, moved into bed and breakfast for pigs. It's not what you'd think.
You mean bed and breakfast and pigs, not bed and breakfast for pigs?
Bed and breakfast for pigs, in a way, right. Yes. He didn't own the pigs. They came and made use of the big facility of the... Because we had a lot of covered-in yard, and he split it up and designed it so that it was ideal for them, because we all had an outside area as well as inside, and all on straw and stuff, so it was ideal.
We finished pigs for Pilgrims Europe, who were a massive company. Some people call it a bed and breakfast setup. They pay for the feed and we pay for the labour and the straw. Yeah, they come in at about 5 weeks old. We take them all the way to slaughter weight.
In more recent times at the Grange, they've had to diversify even further, bringing in new income streams. Jack Harrison again.
One of the main ones has been expanding the livery yard. So we've now got 20 horses on the yard. We've also done various different rentals. In the old grain store, we let as a storage yard. We've also holiday let in the woodlands called Box and Birch. It's been increasingly important to diversify into different areas. There just aren't the margins they used to be profitable. Both need to be commercially quite large, with pig numbers and number of birds for the eggs. Successful, you've got to diversify as well. You know, with the ever-changing markets with feed and all your costs basically going up all the time, it's important to be able to diversify to be able to make a profit.
Back at Manor Farm, David and his wife Jane took a groundbreaking decision 20 years ago. They set up a children's day nursery on the farm, one of the very few in the country.
We're out on the farm. When we first set up, there was a lot of risk-averse thinking, oh, you can't do that on a farm and everything. And thinking, well, actually, why not? Because we'd been brought up in the countryside. We knew our children had done very well out of it. And what kept driving us forward, really, was the fact that we had to diversify and bring in another enterprise in order to maintain a living. We wanted children to be confident around food, to have good diets, to have a healthy lifestyle. There are some nurseries about like that, but we've been very lucky because it's obviously our land. And, you know, we're lucky enough to be able to help children understand where their food comes from, but not just on a small scale. Yes, we have a vegetable plot and they grow things, but also to link that to farming. You know, if the combine comes, wow, that's mega exciting because we get the children out to see and they're making those connections. And you know what? You know, children have got to be in it to know it and to understand about diversity and you know, they'll be looking after this planet for us. And to have these experiences, it's just massive.
Most people in the farming community believe that the very small farms of the past, growing small acreages of crops and keeping a few cows and pigs and chickens, simply couldn't survive now without other sources of income. It's easy to create a picture of doom, and it is true that many small farms have disappeared, and it's harder to attract new people into the business, and virtually impossible to buy a farm unless you have serious money behind you, or a tax burden to alleviate. But as ever, Village Voices looks for the green shoots and the optimistic route. And in the microclimate of Legbourne and Cawthorpe, they're there to be found. Steve Clary, with his father Alan, used to run a pig unit, but now concentrate on crops grown on about 300 acres. And it works for them without diversifying.
No. I mean, I've sort of managed what we can manage within a family between us and kept my workload based around that, really. And that's where I've kept myself fairly busy and not had that spare, you know, not had any spare time to where you was looking to find something else, I suppose.
Unlike some small to medium farms, the Clarys haven't gone down the route of joining a cooperative of other similar farms. But Steve is edging into a working relationship with a neighbour.
Not majorly, no, but I've recently been working with a local lad, a similar size, smaller farmer, and he has suggested that sort of thing, exchange of work, spraying, that sort of thing. So, yeah, it is something that I'm open to, but it's got to be a two-way street where you can work with someone and you're both of the same sort of, in the same similar position, I suppose, really.
He can definitely see the benefits of sharing the load in these expensive times.
I suppose time, really. Having someone you can call on to do them jobs where you just haven't physically got the time to do it. You can being able to make a phone call and have someone come and do that for you is a massive help. It's a massive help.
And can that be a help as well in defraying the costs of equipment?
It can. Yeah, it can, because equipment's massively expensive. Yeah, you could have someone where who purchased one piece of equipment, you purchased another, and then literally he does that job for you, and then you head off and do his jobs with your piece of equipment.
It helps with the social life as well. We've said you're a very busy man, and that must impact on your social life, or how do you manage to squeeze social life into that?
Well, we're in the pub now. Yeah, we always find time for a pint.
Sharing the load can work in another way too. There's a perception that really big farms are something akin to killer whales, swallowing up anything nearby with a voracious, never-to-be-satisfied appetite. And that can be true. But if your big neighbour wants to be part of an ecosystem which relies on big and small working together, it can have enormous benefits for all.
It should be a benefit, not a negative. You know, and there's plenty of times people ring us up, they need a hand. You know, we can be there, we've got equipment and machines and good people that we can get jobs done quickly and help out. And the seed drill now, you're looking £160,000-£170,000. We run three, and to put another 200 or 300 acres a season in isn't, you know, it's well within our capability to do it. When the phone rings, we can, you know, we can drop in, drill 100, 200 acres for someone in a half a day. I think helping those guys out gives us a bit of contracting income, and they've got the security of knowing that the latest technology is there if and when they need it.
Simon King is J. Wharton Agriculture's farm manager. And when I say big, in their case, it's huge. They farm 6,000 acres across the foot of the Wolds, including land in and around Cawthorpe and Legburn. He calls what they're doing forming partnerships.
The more we can generate what we need ourselves, the more insulated we are from those kinds of things, and, you know, the better and more sustainable we'll be in long term. So that's why we're, you know, forming these partnerships, really, I suppose, with other farms. We have what they need. They need access to land, they need straw, they need feed, all of which, you know, we're arable producers. We can supply that, and we can have what they need in return, whether that's grass in arable or muck back, you know, a guaranteed sale for our product locally. It's a good thing for us because it's skilled, motivated labour force, and for them it's some income, and at a time of year maybe they haven't got a huge amount on. So there's plenty of other skills that we can utilise through slack times in the arable production cycle.
What they're definitely not doing, he says, is eating up everything around them and expanding just for the sake of it. They've built up steadily and carefully since the early 70s. They need the scale to justify investment in hugely expensive equipment, in people, and the community as well.
We've got the work, we can justify taking people on and training people up. It's a team of 10 here, including some sort of 16, 17-year-olds. So it's important for us to have the work to be able to do that and bring people in. You know, they've got houses on the farm, they've got young families now to go to local schools. It's that community that you build it. There's quite a lot of things we can do around just the arable crops. Woodland management, we've planted at least 8 miles of hedges in the last 5 years with hedgerow trees. You know, they need looking after. There's lots of other skills that our guys can learn that's going to add value to the farm and to the community.
Big farms make those who remember and farmed in the slower times when soil was paramount, fed naturally and sometimes rested, feel nervous about its future.
I mean, it's all now, they don't plough at all, do they? They can't do it. People can't do it because of the price situation. You've got to be growing something all the time, haven't you? It's wheat, wheat after wheat after wheat after wheat.
When I had my dad's little standard Ford and two for a ransom plough, you would plough, just over 2 acres a day, wouldn't you, wheat? Then they've got these here big fancy tractors, plough over 100 acres a day, and they want to know what you've been doing while now. It's all get on and go.
Today, they don't put anything back in the soil. They just apply fertiliser. If they didn't use fertiliser and chemicals, the land would be barren. We have got the most expensive farming system in the world because we're having to use more and more chemicals and fertilisers to get the crop.
Simon King says Whartons have learned the lessons of the past. They do, he says, care for the land.
So the reason for having the muck for straws, we bale everything. It all goes away and comes back as manure in some shape or form, which is important. It's a good source of nutrients, good for the soil. And same with having the grass. So we rotate the grass around the arable area. That'll get sheep grazed through the winter as well. We'll grow in cover crops as well, which we'll graze off, stubble turnips. And then our rotation's at least 6 years, sort of bringing in different crops, fodder beets and things like that, that are a good feed, but something slightly different for the soil.
They're also going back to more traditional methods of weed control, like harrowing, and they've stopped using insecticides on cereals and rape. They're training up a young workforce, working alongside smaller neighbours, helping to rebuild a rural community. It's one pointer to the future, one way to keep smaller farms alive. So, is there a future for small?
That is a $1 million question. Depending on the government, yes or no. At the moment, probably not so much. My own family farm is just one of these small farms, and we're downsizing every year, more consistently than ever. But I don't have a right or wrong answer. It is a bit of one of them, and we just have to see what happens over the next 10, 20 years, I suppose.
Jack Cullen is the county chairman of the Lincolnshire Federation of Young Farmers Clubs. No crystal ball, he says, but he is optimistic about the future.
I'm just having to be a bit choice with my words here, because I'm used to dropping myself in it. Yeah, I am optimistic. A bit like I've said, there's a lot of worries, and we all hold a lot of weight on our shoulders. But there is a great generation coming through, and I'm seeing that from the forefront here in Young Farmers. And I know that if they put their minds to something, they can do whatever they need, achieve whatever they want. So I'm not worried at all that agriculture will be here to stay. It's just whether or not we're supported by the people down in London.
He accepts that if you're not from a farming family, it's more or less impossible to buy your way in. But there are still, he says, ways to get into agriculture. Things like tenanting, leasing, land sharing, or moving into other areas of agriculture like technology and the feed sector. And the opportunities and the young people wanting them are there in Lincolnshire.
There is an abundance of work out there at the moment as well. There are jobs out there for them. It's just whether or not anyone will give them the opportunity. And in agriculture, they will give them the opportunity. They will give them the training.
Kate Knight is the County Development Manager for the Young Farmers Clubs Federation. The clubs, she says, can really help to point the way.
Being a young farmer member exposes young farmers to other young farmers and non-young farmers, of course, as well, but exposes them to loads of aspects of the industry that they may or may not know about. Maybe a young person sees an aspect of the industry, some of the things that Jack was just talking about, that they didn't know, you know, that farming isn't just sitting on tractors or, like Jack said, owning a farm, but there are lots of sort of additional sectors of the industry that put them into agriculture, but they don't have to own a farm or sit on a tractor.
Jack Harrison is a realist, but he doesn't believe smaller farms are dead in the water.
Not necessarily. We're quite small, but we've managed to develop by numbers of livestock as well as diversifying into different areas. So there is opportunities out there without having a massive amount of land. So yeah, it's looking into the different markets and based on what suits you to what you're interested in, really.
He agrees with Jack Cullen that the rapidly advancing technology sector of farming is a huge attraction for the young, and there are new opportunities born from the need to diversify.
The technology's advancing very quickly, so I think keeping people interested will be down to the advancements in technology. So there's going to be a lot of different areas people are going to be needing to train for. We've recently taken on an apprentice later this year who's going to be studying at Rhizome. So there's going to hopefully be lots what they can teach us as well from the advancements what are ever-changing in agriculture.
He says thinking outside the box, finding a market or specialist area that others ignore, is a must for smaller farms. Simon King agrees.
You probably need to specialise. If you're going to grow wheat, you need to grow wheat that you can sell at a premium. If you have oats, you know, we grow a certain type of unhusked oat at a premium. We grow vining pea seed. Things that people are going to pay you a premium for that, you know, add value to what you're doing already. Not necessarily changing your entire system, but slightly adapting it to go down things that other people maybe go, well, I'm not doing that, that's hard work.
One side of the path to future survival, the side that takes in tax burdens, soaring costs and labour shortages, is in the hands of people outside farming. But on the other side of that path, the message that rings out loud and clear is that working together in some shape or form is the key.
We're almost going back in time, actually. So my grandfather would say that him and his neighbours used to own one tractor between them and work together. There are a few farms now looking to do that.
Like I say, if you can work with someone who's of the same, similar kind of size acreage, I guess, your equipment would mould into their world as well as theirs would mould to yours.
I think the more people you have invested in your success and the more you get invested in other people's success, the stronger you are. A lot of people looking out for you and I'm wanting you to do well, because you doing well means they do well. You know, that's the best way to keep the wheels turning, really.
It's hard, yeah, but you hope that you're always going to be able to make enough to keep doing what you're doing. You get a lot just from the outdoors part of it, you know, the nature and everything that's around you, and growing what you're doing, growing crops, plants and so on. So there's always something changing, you know, as the seasons go by, leaves dropping off the trees. It's nature, yeah.
And you definitely see yourself, this is what you're going to be doing for the rest of your life, do you think?
Oh, yeah, now, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm too old to change now.
Steve Clary, winding up episode 4 of Legbourne and Courthorpe Village Voices. You've been listening to Farming Lives. Coming soon, gripping yarns and local legends.